Oh, I think we're live. No, now we're live. Hi, this is Susan Sherman, and I'm the author of The Little Russian. And who am I speaking to today?
You are speaking to Robert Masello. I am the author of a couple of books, Blood and Ice and The Medusa Amulet.
Yes, you are. You've gotten on a lot of books under your belt. So here we are, and we're about to talk about, what are we about
to talk about? The
Little Russian. I thought we were going to talk about yogurt. I just found, like, the best yogurt. But I'm not getting paid for a commercial, so I won't get into that. The Little Russian.
Which I have been reading. And, Susan, as you already know, I'm not going to lie, I have just, that we've talked about this before, it's a terrific book. And it's akin to things
this,
that,
by the way.
Yeah, it's akin to things that I've done, so I can really appreciate how hard it is to weave history and fact into fiction and make it all come together and make it all breathe. And this is not just because, I'll admit it, we're friends. I was really amazed at how well you've done that. The book is spectacular.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
And it's a huge relief for me, by the way, because you know when a friend writes a book, you're obliged to call up and say, terrific book, even if you could only get through three pages. And in this case, it was such a relief because I took it home and I started reading it and I could not put it down. The way that you've evoked Russia at the early 1900s, the villages, the shtetls, Moscow itself, St. Petersburg, it really came alive for me. And since I'm writing something similar, I just thought there's so much here I could steal.
Be my guest. And then I'll steal it back for my next book.
But, I mean, how long did it take you, actually, to write this book? It seems like it must have been a labor of many years.
Yeah. I was working on this book for 8 years, believe it or not.
Wow.
And, at least two of those years were spent on research. You know how research is. And, you know, you just get into it and you can't stop. I mean, I love researching, so...
But I think that's a valuable question. You bring up something there. How do you know when to stop? When did you know that you were doing all this research and it was time now to actually start writing this story, or you felt comfortable doing it?
Yeah. For me, I know when I can stop researching, when I'm actually living more in that world, in the world of the late 19th, early 20th century, than I am in this world. And when I write, I don't even remember any of the research. I'm just there, and I can just, you know, I just know that when I walk into a room, I'm going to see gaslight or whatever it is, you know, and I'm not, you know, it's just, I'm there. So that's what
I know.
I
when
know
it just comes to hand.
Yeah, when it just comes to hand, and you don't even think about it. And, you know, it's hell on my family, because my mind is always on that book and in that period, and it's really hard for them to have a conversation with me. But, yeah,
it's like walking around. I always compare it to, it's like walking around with your head in this bubble. And for me, a novel, especially these big historical fiction novels that you write now and that I've been writing, it's like walking around and you're afraid when too many people want to like talk to you and there's too many things other than the book happening. It's like the bubble's going to burst. And it's only as long as I walk around with that bubble around my head that I can contain everything that's in that world of the novel, wherever it's set, whatever it is.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing that's so weird is that once you're in that bubble, like all the other sounds of this world are kind of muted. There's like, blah, 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 and people are talking to you, and you kind of get like what they're saying mid-sentence, but you don't really know what the subject of what they're saying. You know, you don't know the subject of the sentence.
Yeah, you hear that something is on fire. You know,
something is on fire.
What is the house
Someone
on fire?
Died.
Is it just the roast? If it's the roast, no big deal.
Yeah.
If it's the house, I guess I have to pay attention, but can't you deal with it? I'm in the middle of a really important scene.
And it's so funny because then you just go like, wait, who are you talking about? And they know. I mean, they know. They say, oh, they go, do I have to start all over? And I go, yeah. So they have to start all over. And then
your mother calls. He's in the hospital. It was a three-car accident. You go, oh, all right. Guess I should have been paying attention the first time.
And don't you just find at night that when you – I don't know about you, but I can't put it down even at night. So at night when I'm trying to go to sleep, I'm like thinking of dialogue and You know, I'm saying.
Yeah,
I
envy my readers. Millions of them can put my books down. but I can't do the same. I can't turn it off.
Isn't it awful? I know.
You know, at night you're lying there and you're thinking of, and also you're thinking about the day's work even, and you're going, oh, I missed such an opportunity there.
Yeah, you go back.
I wrote one book, and I can't believe, I mean, really, honestly, I wrote this book, and I wove in this bells ringing in New York motif through the whole book, the whole purpose of which was it was going to give me this boffo conclusion. Mm-hmm. And, of course, by the time I got to the end of the book, I wrote it completely ignoring and forgetting all about how I built in these bells all the way through the book previous. And the book comes out, I go, wait a minute. The bells were supposed to ring. That was supposed to be the thing that said, wow, this is really a literary book. Look how he wove that leitmotif all the way through it and paid off. I forgot to pay it off.
And nobody noticed it? No, your editor didn't notice it or anything?
That was one of those books. I used to be so cocky. That was one of those books that I've had some of them published without the editor, I think, ever really reading it.
Oh, wow.
I've had... You know, I have an editor now at Bantam Random House who's terrific and who really does go over everything. But for a while I thought, I'm the best writer in the world. I just turn stuff in and they publish it. and it was because a lot of the books are earlier, some of them were just paperbacks, and I think maybe some assistant read them over and went, yeah, it's great. And the mm-hmm. editor was very busy, and I was convinced in a couple of cases that the book had not really been read.
Oh, my God. Yeah, well... You do that. I mean, you do that when you're writing, and you just kind of lose sight of those little tiny little details that, I mean, usually I catch it before. Well, the other thing is, don't you hate reading your published books to yourself? I mean,
oh, yeah.
Because then you see certain mistakes. Like there's one word in the beginning of my book that I want to change. I want to go to all the copies and go, I'm
What's
so glad
word?
You brought my book. It should be in wire. It should be tightrope. I just want to change wire to tightrope. And I want to do, you know, as they bring it up and I sign it, I just want to turn to the first page and cross out that word and put tightrope. I don't know.
They wouldn't think you were too crazy as you annotated every copy with 300 people waiting in line.
But really neatly, like just print it, like over that word. That would be great.
Yeah, I wanted to strike out whole scenes from books. I mean... There was a wild but silly sex scene in a book I wrote years ago, and it just killed me. And I kept begging. And I said, as the book was in galleys and all, I kept saying, "Please, please take that out. I'm mortified. My mother will read this. My friends will read this. They'll know what my little fantasies are. It's too shameful." And they promised me. They said, "All right, already. Of course we'll do it." Even as behind the scenes, they're going, "Roll presses." I mean, nothing had been changed. It came out with that. And to this day, whenever I see a copy of that book, I want to just grab it and go, excuse me one moment while I remove pages 312 and 313. Trust me, it won't disturb the narrative. It's just a horrible little glimpse into the dark sexual fantasies of its author.
Now, you know I want to get the title of that book and go out and buy it right away. And
you'll notice I didn't mention which book it was.
Oh, God. Oh,
but I think your book is what is one of the things I liked about it so much, which, and there were many things, was the details that we're talking about, which are always in the right place, and they are just the one that you need, whether you are describing, you know, how a wheat merchant goes about his business or what furnishings there are in a prosperous merchant's house in a backwater town, whatever. You've got all of those things from the China cups to the samovars, et cetera, exactly right. And it gives the reader, in this case me, it gives me the sense that I'm really in safe hands with you, that I'm reading this book and that all of this stuff is right, and that I'm getting a real feel for the history, that I'm getting a real feel for this is what life was like. And I think that that's so important that readers get the sense that they can trust the author whose hands they are in.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. The thing is, you know, you and I both agree, and we've talked about this, but when you read historical fiction and the author stops the narrative, you know, and the drive to tell you about some irrelevant detail that you don't need to know for the story, it just takes you out of the story. And even though you want to learn everything about that period, you want to learn that everything about that period through the viewpoint of your characters and through their emotional – ties to whatever it is you're talking about. So if you're talking about a teacup, well, the character kind of has to care about that teacup, or that teacup has to have a reason for being there, not just the teacup.
Right. Is it a gold-rimmed teacup? Is it a chipped teacup? Is it from some, you know, is it fine china, or is it locally made? Tells you everything about the character.
Yeah, and like, what? How does that character really care about this teacup? Does that teacup stand for some image that that character is trying to project in her, his or her world? And all those things are, you know, they need to be there for a reason in order to push your story forward. And you know, and then it
famous...
worked. In...
Go ahead, sorry.
No. I had nothing more to say. Believe me.
Yeah, no. There was. Well, it just made me think there was a famous book, and I won't mention the author, but it was a good book, but it was historical fiction published about 20 years ago, probably now.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember reading it and enjoying it, and a lot of it was set in New York in the 1900s. But the author plainly had come across the complete menu of Delmonico's restaurant. And the characters go to Delmonico's, which was a popular joint, I guess, at that time. And he basically, the author stops to tell us every single item on the menu. Not that that's completely uninteresting, but we don't need to know that. All I needed to see was what two or three of the characters ordered, and that would give me a sense of what kind of, you know, food people ate then, what kind of stuff was served at what price at Delmonico's. You could see that the author was so in love with his research, which is easy to do. It's easy to fall in love with this stuff.
Yeah.
But he couldn't let it go and forgot, no, I'm supposed to be writing a story with narrative propulsion, and people are following that. They're not reading a history text.
Yeah, I mean, to me, when that happens in a novel, I feel that, and I could be wrong, but I feel like the author didn't research enough. Like, they came up with 5 or 6 things that they really wanted to use. But if they researched so much and they came up with tons and tons of things that they forgot, but they're just in the back of their minds and it just comes forth as they're writing, then it will come out naturally. But if they are holding on to just a small number of facts or images or whatever from that period, then they'll work them into the story too much. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I can even tell when I'm doing it, because, you know, if you're sort of making a detour just to make sure that you get in that information you found out about the building of the Hoover Dam or whatever it is, you can tell, you're like, oh, this is really sort of taking me far afield just because I'm so in love with this and I want to get it in and I want to show off that I know this or that I learned this.
Yeah, and the thing is that if you just write your story and you know enough about your period, all those things will come out naturally, and some things you'll never use, but oh well, you know, there's other things that you will use. And so,
what was it, Faulkner's line, I think, was, you must kill all your darlings, and by which he meant, which I never completely agreed with, by the way. I coddle my darlings, and the few that I have, I keep. But his notion, of course, was that if you went out of your way and you had some glorious sentence that kind of stuck out or a phrase that was just too beautiful for the rest of the prose, that it probably needed to be excised. And sometimes you need to do that even with historical stuff. You go through and you say, okay, this really isn't germane. I'll have to save it for another book, or it's not worth the trip.
This reminds me of this, speaking about sex scenes, this reminds me of the sex scene that I wrote for this book, which thankfully it's not in the book. But I was so proud of it, and it was so florid, I guess, like, and graphic, I guess. And I just remember, you know, being a little embarrassed by it, but turning it into my editor, and my editor just writing back, "Someone's read her Kama Sutra."
Kama Sutra.
Yeah.
And I got
crossed out the whole thing. You know, when somebody
crosses
out
a book
your sex scene. What?
Sorry. I wrote a book years ago called The Spirit Wood, in which I had it was all about Greek mythology, and a guy inherits an estate in Long Island, becomes very corrupted. Anyway, there was a little wild stuff, I thought, in the book. But a screenwriter was given the job of writing a treatment of the book, and because they were thinking about making a movie of it at one time, and we can talk about that. But I got the treatment. It was like 45 pages long, and it was pretty skillfully done. But I complained because I said, you know, what I wrote was a fairly classy Tony book, and this thing is every other page is there's an orgy with goats involved, and there's people hanging off of balconies, and there's naked girls running across the lawn with champagne bottles in hand. Where did all this come from? And the guy said, your book, pal. And I went back and read it, and I thought, oh, my God, I did. What astonished me was I'd written quite a sleazy little book without knowing it. I mean, the scenes that he had in there, I'm thinking, oh, that actually is there. And I still can't, it was my first novel, and I still can't believe I not only did that, but that I sent copies to both my mother and my father, which, by the way, is something we could discuss. My parents were divorced.
I just had this huge thing about that. My parents are all up in arms right now. I hope they never listen to them. Now, if they listen to this, they're going to be even more up in arms. Yeah, there's this huge flack in my family because of something I wrote. I mean, don't you hate that when that happens?
But why is your family up in arms?
Blog post for my blog on the website, which has since been taken down, and which I will not mention what it was about. It was about a member of my family, and it was, you know, kind of a light little comedy. I didn't think anybody would be offended. And, oh, my God, this fireworks. And so, anyway, we're dealing with that right now. But
when I sent that first copy, so hot off the press, of the first novel to my parents, one to my mom in Chicago, one to my dad in Florida, I waited like a week. I waited 2 weeks. I waited 3 weeks. I thought, the mail can't be this slow. I didn't hear anything. I finally brought it up once on the phone with my mother, and I said, did you get the book? And she said, yes, I did, Punky. I said, you know, what'd you think? And there was a long pause, and then she said, leisurely, wasn't it? I thought, well, that's a pretty good synonym for boring. And I thought, well, I'll get no comfort here. So I called my father in Florida, and I said, what did you think of the book? And he said, it's the kind of book your mother will like. And I said, well, no, in point of fact, she found it leisurely, i.e. boring. And that was, I think, the last time I bothered to send them copies. You know, they're better off not knowing, you know?
Yeah. Well, no, they love the book, but it's just the blog post they didn't like. So I don't know. You write certain things, and you know you really want to write certain things, but you know you're going to piss off somebody. So, you know, then you have to make a choice between artistic freedom. I want to elevate it. You know, it's not just like me trying to get material. It's I want to elevate it into artistic freedom or, you know.
Yes.
Or you're going to piss off your friends or your family. But
there's always somebody who can. But I think you and I get around that a little bit. At least, I don't always. But when we're writing the historical stuff, it's less likely that our friends and family are going to find themselves there. It's when I write domestic and current stuff that you're always worried, is my friend Bill going to see himself in the skinflint who will never pick up a lunch check or something like that, you know?
But I just got
in trouble.
But, you know, I do use my friends and family in my book, in guises. Oh, yeah, I mean, my characters come from, even though they're, you know, they're in a shtetl and it's, you know, 1896 or whatever, they're there. But they're an amalgamation of different people, so I'm not too worried about that because I think that they won't be able to recognize them. A lot of times, you know, you can write somebody who is exactly like this person, and they'll laugh at it, and they'll make fun of this character, and they won't know it's them, but it's so them, you know?
Yes, exactly. And they will, and people will recognize themselves in characters that bear almost, in your mind, no resemblance. It wasn't a connection you were making.
Yeah, right.
So there's kind of no winning that battle. I mean, who's going to see himself or herself? I mean, years ago, I got really leery of it. I was writing a column in Mademoiselle called His years ago, and I was writing about my dating life, you know, so it was a pretty arid column. And anything that happened to me, I would include it. But, you know, even if I changed, you know, Claire to Celeste, I mean, Claire knew who she was.
Uh-huh.
And it was really dangerous because I was writing really close to the bone and from, you know, recent experience.
Can you hear what's going on in the background?
Yeah, that's a little machine you have that makes the sound of a dog barking, right?
The dogs are fighting. Okay, guys.
That's to lend verisimilitude to this and make it seem like we're not like really slick pros.
Yeah, no. Well, the dog, because I had somebody walk the dogs this morning, and they fight once they get in the house. I mean, they, you know, they'd have a dog fight once they get in the house. So that's what we just heard as them.
My dog will probably erupt any moment too if the mailman comes or something like that. But and also, you know, here's something I always like to ask other writers, because I always feel like I'm the laziest guy in the world. But how much do you get done every day? Are you on a rigorous schedule? I mean, do you get 500 words done between the hours of 9 and 11 every day, or do you kind of work as catch can when you have a moment? And
oh, you know, I work every day, but I don't, you know, I usually try to do, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 pages, and I always start with.
So that's like 700-800 words or so, probably typed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And then I always go back to the previous pages, and just rewrite them, and then that kind of gets me in the mood for the new pages. Because I love rewriting. I mean, we talked about this yesterday, but I love rewriting. It's the empty page syndrome that gets me. So
yeah.
I just kind of throw up on the page. I just write anything
right.
just to fill up that page, and then I can start rewriting. And that's really comforting. You know, I really – my favorite thing.
I think that's what separates us. You're a genuine crafts person. You know, you really can't – I hate the rewriting part because I just like to think that the first rush must have been genius. I write it and I move on, and the idea that when an editor or a copy editor comes back to me and says this whole section's unclear, it's so crushing to me because I think, you know, didn't Hamlet come out in the first draft just fine? I mean, why am I having to do this? And yet I know it's needed, but...
Yeah, no, I love that. I mean, I love it when my editor comes back and says, okay, we need this here, we need this here, and this here. I love rewriting. You know, it's just the writing, just the first thing that's hard.
But that's also if you trust your editor, as clearly you do and did this book.
Oh, yeah. No, my editor, we are just... You know, we're really he probably doesn't think so. I consider myself very close to him. You know, he's a good friend. I mean, we've become friends over the process,
uh-huh.
and he's just an amazing, amazing editor, and I trust him. So whatever he says, I'll try. And even if it doesn't work, then I'll go back to him. I'll say I tried it this way and that way, and it doesn't work. But usually, it does work. And you know, usually, I mean, he can see things that I just, you know, I'm so close that I can't see it. So,
and that's a great point. As a writer, you're so close to your material that something that is, I usually find is the thing that's completely obvious or should be, you know, that the guy has only one arm or something, and I forgot to mention it. It's because I saw him that way, and you need an editor to say, you know, you need to mention actually that he's missing an arm or something. I mean that. It's not the small things. It's usually something really big that I sort of forgot to hit that note hard enough for the reader. And the editor comes in and points that out in addition to small things like, you know,
I
got the years wrong again.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I did that. Because I don't, you know, we, where are we? What year are we? You know, we had to, like, really get that down. And then also, I just remember... the first note I think I ever got from him, or one of the first notes, was in the first. It was in chapter one, and I'm going along, and I'm describing Bear to the protagonist, and she's coming down the stairs, and she's going off on a journey, and then we go on and on, and then we talk about this woman, Rosa Davidovna, and I failed to mention who this character was, and I'm just talking about her like everyone should know who she was, and he's like, who is this person and when did she come into the story? You know, it's
right.
That kind of thing. So
I'm always amazed when other people have read my material so much more closely than I have. And you also do hear in this age of the internet, you obviously, I'm sure you do, I certainly have for many years, you know, you hear from authorities in every possible area who want to catch you on one thing or another and correct you. I've got a retired weatherman in Florida who's apparently a real science buff, and there's a fair amount of science in some of my books. And he just loves to send me long emails. And, you know, in one book, Blood and Ice, my characters are like traveling in the Antarctic, and a guy looks over his shoulder and sees the sun on the horizon. And I got this blistering email saying, you know, any idiot would know that if you're traveling in a southerly direction at the pole, the sun would be over your right shoulder, not your left, and hovering at a 30-degree angle, hardly 60 degrees, as you described. How foolish can you be, sir, to be going, I'm sorry. I'll fix it in a later edition, I promise you. But there is always somebody who knows more about every particular thing than you do.
Yeah,
and I feel that our job, I don't know how you feel, but it isn't to get, this is going to sound terrible, we try to get as much right as we can, but you can't get everything right.
Yeah. You know, it's not nonfiction, guys. We do the best we can, and we create a world. And if one element, like I have this one thing where Herschel, one of my main characters, he's talking about his mother, and he's explaining that she had, you know, beautiful long fingers, which helped her play Rachmaninoff, which is really hard to play. Well, my own son, the traitor that he is, pointed out that Rachmaninoff wouldn't have written anything that would be hard to play in that time period, that would come maybe 20 years later. So it's too late now. It's in there.
Right.
And now I have to live with that mistake.
Yeah. I mean, and you can't expect to get everything right. I mean, I got one book I wrote there was a brain surgery going on, and I did get to hear from an old friend from high school who wrote me and said, hey, I enjoyed your book, but I've become a brain surgeon. So if you write any more scenes of brain surgery, you really might want to call me first. Apparently, I put a couple of pesky little glands or lobes in the wrong place. I mean... But I feel that, and I don't know whether this is me or some other fine writer like Richard Rhodes who invented this differentiation, but there's writers of verisimilitude and there's writers of veracity. And it's like, even in Ulysses, I mean, Joyce made sure that everything that he describes on Bloomsday actually was right, that he turns at this particular corner and the theater is showing this particular play, that it was all exact. But I feel like our job is to create verisimilitude. And if we get enough of it right to carry 98% of our readers through, even though there's always going to be an expert or somebody who knows that you hit a bump, then we've done our job well enough that the reader was carried along. We didn't stop him up with something like the Rachmaninoff thing. It didn't stop me. Yes, there's some musical scholars who will know, but... You know, the rest of us go, right, you know, fine. We roll with it.
Right, exactly. You're talking about brain surgery, and I was thinking of, I better not say. There's one very, very famous, wonderful, wonderful writer who had a very, very long, I guess it was 3 or 4 pages of brain surgery. And I'm just thinking, like, wow, he was just showing off all of his brain surgery stuff, and it was amazing, but, you know.
Which is always a great party trick. I mean, hey, everybody, let me divert the conversation to brain surgery just for 10 minutes.
It was a long, long brain surgery. It was like, probably, you know, in real time is what I'm thinking, you know, so. But anyway.
But I also, something we have touched on, which is when you're doing the research, which can get very, you know, tedious after a while. I mean, I know friends who've really gotten lost in those corridors. They start researching stuff and they never come back out again. One thing I always found that was really helpful was, this is not going to sound too terrific, but there's a couple things. One is I just watch vintage movies or movies that, you know, are about that era. It's amazing. Because, you know, the costumers and set designers have done some of your work. So if you want to see New York at a certain time, Washington Square, you can watch the heiress and you can watch how they outfitted Olivia de Havilland. And that'll give you an idea, too. You know, how is Montgomery Clift dressed? How does he talk? What does he play on the piano? So it's a great, easy way to sit around, watch movies, giving yourself an excuse to do that and still be doing research. And I also read novels in the era. I find that if I'm writing something that's set in, say, London in the 1840s or whatever, I just can read Dickens novels.
Yeah.
You know he's got it right. You know that whatever his characters are drinking and eating and how they're traveling around the city, you know, is going to be accurate. It's an absolutely painless way of doing your research.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, for me, I actually, well, for the book I'm researching now, there's actually vintage, like part of the story is set around the 1900 exposition in Paris, and they actually have like vintage newsreels, and I can watch, you know, actually see the whole thing. I mean, this were
those are that's fabulous.
Yeah, I mean, you see this, you know, they had a you know, an automatic, you know, sidewalk, a moving sidewalk, and you know, and they this is like when electricity became huge, and so they have this big you know, electrical exhibition. I mean, it's just interesting to see all these people at the fair, and it's wonderful.
Boy, when you can find something like that, I mean, if you're writing about an era in which there actually is some kind of, you know, film to be watched, that's spectacular when you
can
see that.
I know. And then there's also, for this book, for Little Russian, I looked at hundreds and hundreds of photographs of the era, and it was amazing because you got it all right. I mean, that's where I got a lot of my scene description was because I could see it and put it together. And, you know, there's just a lot of archival information, photographs, and, you know, aside from the books that I read, memoirs are really helpful. So, you know, because they...
memoirs are terrific, yeah.
Yeah, they give a really...
I found, I was writing that book, The Medusa Amulet, and it's about the Italian Renaissance in large measure. And I found, actually, they've reprinted journals that were written by merchants in Florence and Venice from that era. Just recording, you know, what they were buying, what they were selling, where they were going.
Yeah.
And it was just great. I mean, that was just firsthand stuff. It tells you exactly how life was lived.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, historical books, you know, books that give you a larger overview are good for a larger overview. But they don't give you the little day-to-day details that you absolutely have to have. And for that, you just have to be creative. You have to go to little weird sources. And, I mean, I have a book that was written by just a bunch of people. I guess they live here in the United States. And they used to live, they came from a shtetl in Russia, and they all came from the same shtetl, and so they were talking about it. And each one had like a little story, and each one, actually there were four shtetls represented, and each one had a little story and little, the people of importance in their shtetls. And it was just really, and it was written in a very naive style, because they weren't writers.
Right.
But it was great. It was just this wealth of information. So,
when you started the book, did you know, I mean, because people always ask me this, you know, about my own, and I'm just wondering, I mean, when you started The Little Russian, did you know where she was going to wind up? I mean, how much of your story did you know going in, or did you start with just a vague sense of the outline, and did you outline?
Yeah. No, I never outline. I outline, like, maybe 2 pages, you know, just block, you know. But, well, it was based on my grandmother's story, so I had kind of a direction. All right, so, and a lot of her, what happened to her, not a lot, but, you know, some of what happened to her is in the novel. It's woven into the story of the novel. But I didn't have an ending. It was, I struggled with the ending. You know, it took me so long, and I wrote so many endings, and they were all just these long-winded, just kept going on and on. Like, you know, you expect it to end, and then it just wouldn't, and then...
Would you like to use a little leitmotif of bells ringing?
And then
it's
you
a
keep
great
writing, and it wouldn't fucking end, and you just want to beat the life out of it, you know, and it just wouldn't end. And then finally I just went, wait, I can just cut all of this, all of this, you know, pages and pages and pages, and just end it right here. And it worked really well.
Oh, good.
Well,
you know, I haven't actually gotten to the very end of the book yet because I only picked it up, as you know, a couple nights ago.
Yeah.
But I heard Robert Stone, who's one of my favorite novelists, you know, the author of A Flag for Sunrise and Outer Bridge Reach and Hall of Mirrors. He was actually my writing teacher in college, one of them. And somebody asked him that once, like, how do you know when your novel is done? How do you know when you're finished? Mm-hmm. And he even looked blank and he said, well, you know, the sound of gunfire becomes sporadic, then quiet. There's very few people seen standing around anymore. You know, I sort of get the feeling everyone's gone. He feels like, guess this book is done. But I mean, people always think you're going towards this, you know, boffo conclusion that you've all worked out in advance, and I never have either. I mean, I'm suddenly left. I always feel that when you write a book, you start out, you're throwing a million balls up into the air, and then around the halfway point, they start to come down, and you have to start catching them. And then they're coming down in a real hailstorm. There's all these different plot lines have to be tied up. All these different points have to be made. All these characters have to get certain places. And then finally, you know, towards the very end, there's not many balls coming down. You catch the last few. You look up, nothing's going to hit you in the head. And you go, I think I wrapped everything up. But aren't you surprised? I don't know if, I know I always am, but I always get this note on Amazon. There's always some reader, whichever book it is, who thinks that I purposely left something undone because I'm leaving the door open for a sequel.
Oh, no.
I mean, I am never leaving the door open for a sequel. I never want to have to do this again.
I think that's it.
That's the last one. I'm just going to, I don't know, play the lottery.
Yeah, no. Actually, my editor, I think he was joking, but he said something like that. Oh, we should, you know, do a sequel. But I don't see where a sequel comes. You know, I think he was just joking. But, you know, I mean,
I'm not so sure. Editors do often suggest that, and it's because they think the characters, and your characters do. I mean, Herschel and Berta, they really live on the page. And again, I haven't read the last chapter, so I don't know. But there is an audience that will want to know, and what happens to them next. They're always, with a book as good as yours, there always is an audience for that.
Yeah, just probably just not a writer for it because I'm working on a different thing. But,
Well, and editors often want you to do the same thing. I mean, I've run into this over the years. Mine has been a checkered career with various kinds of books, but they want you to write the same sort of thing and build an audience there. So even for you, they might say, let's do some more, you know, with these characters, or concentrate on Russia and Jewry, and this is what you've written so well. And yet they don't understand that, of course, for us as writers, we get tired of something after you've been with it. In your case, my gosh, 8 years on this
8 years, yeah.
You want to go to a different place. You want to go to the World's Fair, the exposition. You want to go to the Via Veneto. You want to go to a different place in time.
Yeah. You know what's really funny is in my next book, the main character is actually a young Polish girl who her parents want her to leave school and go and work in these horrible factories. And she lives in the slums of Warsaw. So I just wrote the first chapter. I'm not even done with all the research. I just wanted to write the first chapter to get her voice.
Right.
And it takes place in Warsaw in, I guess it's around 1900. And so it's my period, and it's in Eastern Europe, and boy, did that write like butter. Just whoosh, you know?
Really?
Well, of course, then she goes to Paris, and then it's all brand new for me. But in Warsaw...
My stuff writes like concrete.
Well, now it's writing like concrete. Well, because now it's a world I'm not familiar with yet, so I have to do a lot more research and really immerse myself. But Poland, Warsaw, I know a lot about that because... I'm not going to say, but anyway.
But that was an interesting thing that you mentioned, because I think that's the other really important thing is voice, and that's the hardest thing in the world is to figure out. It's one thing even when you're writing a memoir or something to figure out your own voice, because it's still not the voice you speak in when you're sitting around a table with friends. It's still the literary written voice. But when you're writing a novel and you're trying to find the voice of a character, and a character in particularly another time.
Yeah.
It's really hard to get that to sound authentic and not phony or worked up, and to find a voice that isn't yours but that you're comfortable writing in.
Yeah. See, that's why I pretty much like to write about the early 20th century and the late 19th century because, you know, right around the turn of the last century because it's almost modern. I mean, people speak very similar to the way we speak now. It's not they don't use any archaic language. And a lot of the accoutrements of the time are the beginnings of our modern time. And a lot of the thought of that time is very advanced and modern, especially concerning women and women's place in the world and the emerging woman as an independent, thinking, free person. So that's why I really like that time, because it's of another time, but it's also of our time. So it's not that difficult for me to get into the voices of those characters, because they're not that different in some respects to our modern voices today.
No, I agree. It's, I mean, I had to do scenes in the Italian Renaissance and the French Revolution and all of that for the Medusa amulet.
That would be so
and it was
hard.
And it was tough just to like make it sound not silly, and at the same time to make it sound enough different that you know you are in a different era. And I wrote in one book, I had to write scenes of, you know, like British officers in the Crimean War, and this was the 1850s in England. And I said to myself, before I even start writing these sections, I will not use the term "by Jove." I won't have anyone say that. And of course, you know, one day, you know, "by Jove," he declared.
It's tough. It's a fine line. Because you don't want it to be stilted, you want it to be, but you want it to be real. And sometimes, you know, sometimes their language and their speaking style just naturally would sound stilted to our ear. And although, if you read writers of that period, it doesn't sound stilted. You know, it's hard. It's a tough thing to get right. So.
Yeah, a voice that, you know, that you could sustain and that the reader will enjoy, you know, reading.
Yeah.
And I mean, I still find, I mean, even if you read some things by Robert Louis Stevenson or whatever, you know, wonderful as he is, when he goes into the Scottish dialect, it can be hard to parse, you know. It's tough to read some of these things now and and to capture that. And how far do you go in trying to capture it? You know, I usually settle for just a little soupçon, a little taste of it to give the reader a sense of what it might sound like. But I can't do dialect at great length.
Yeah, no, I can't do dialect at all. I wouldn't even try. It would probably just come off so awful if I did it. But, oh, wow. Well, this has been fun.
You and I should do it every morning. I pity the listeners, but...
Well, next time we'll have food. You know, we'll go out to breakfast, and we'll, you know.
We'll invite everybody to meet us someplace, and we can sit down
Susan
and continue
and Robert,
our...
You know, talk over breakfast, yeah.
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you so much for doing this with me.
Well, thank you, Susan Sherman, author of The Little Russian, my favorite new book, which I'm going to dig right back into now.
Well, thank you so much, and we'll talk soon.
Okay, I'll see you soon.
Okay.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one. No is the saddest experience you'll ever know. Yes, it's the saddest experience you'll ever know. Because one is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. One is the loneliest number that you'll ever know. It's just no good anymore since you went away. Now I spend my time just making rhymes of yesterday. Because one is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. One is